The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
And so often in these mini laterals, you're trying to put together a number of things, hoping to create a balance that moves forward. No, all of them aren't going to succeed, but in the collective of it all, trying to move forward this competition that Andrea is speaking about, it is about seeking advantage in this environment, this competitive environment.
And what can give you advantage in one setting can be a disadvantage in others. And so figuring out how do you balance all of that with your economic versus your security interest versus your geographic location, it's complicated.
Plus your narrative, being a certain kind of power.
It is definitely. Aloha and welcome to Strategic Voices. I'm James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel Gainaway Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. I'm joined today by my colleagues, Professors Sham Taquani and Andrea Malji. This is episode 3, Disruption, Division, and Competition in the Indo-Pacific. The Indo-Pacific is not becoming unstable by accident. It is being reshaped and deliberately and unevenly by overlapping forces that are stressing institutions, alliances, and longstanding assumptions about order. Disruption is no longer episodic. Economic shocks, technological acceleration, demographic pressures, supply chain vulnerabilities. Together, they magnify risk and compress decision-making time. Division is no longer confined to borders. It now runs through systems, technology, capital, supply chains, and security networks. Access is increasingly conditional, differentiated, and shaped by trust under stress. And competition is no longer abstract. It is playing out across diplomacy, industry, information, and security, often below the threshold of open conflict, but with real strategic consequences. So the central question today is this: are these dynamics a passing storm, or do they signal a more durable realignment of the Indo-Pacific security environment? Let's begin. Friends, welcome. How's it going?
Good.
Great.
How
to
are
be
you?
Back.
Oh, it is so good to be back, man. Our guests will recognize that this is the second time we've tried to do this episode. The last time, a couple of weeks ago, we thought to do it and we had some tech issues right there at the end. And then Andrea had to get off on an airplane and go somewhere. She's been gone for a while. Maybe you can tell us about that. And finally, we're back together as a team. But actually, this is... Andrew, this is your first time on the show. Tell us a minute about yourself and tell us where you've been.
Yeah. So I have just returned from Philippines and Indonesia. I was there for 2 weeks, taking part in some fellow project and engagements, meeting with different organizations within both of those countries. But I'll backtrack a little bit because I didn't introduce myself there.
Yeah, do that. We had you on Dialogue back on episode 49. So some of the guests will remember you from that. And you talked a little bit about yourself, but just a bit. You've been here a little over a year, right?
Just past 1 year. Yeah. So I've been here for 1 year, civilian faculty, focusing on geopolitics, history of studying South Asia. Before I came here, I was at Hawaii Pacific University for 8 years as faculty there, department chair, and transitioned into this environment.
You've been one of my go-to professors here, asking you to do a number of things, and you have been just a tremendous champion. And so this was one of those things I asked you to do after Lamy went off to IISS in London. It's easy to think that you'd be wonderful on this program. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Sham, what you been up to?
Me? Well, so much has been going on. So much is going on. Just trying to keep track of everything that's going on around the world.
Yeah.
That's a 26 hours, 8 days a week effort. I was just going to mention something. So 2 weeks ago, we couldn't air this. I think for me, that's a very classic case of disruption. It disrupted our schedules.
Very well said. We're going to delve into that deeply today.
Yeah, and so that's what I've been doing. I'm sure everybody else is trying to keep pace with, keep on top of things that are happening around the globe. If you're looking at the particular region, even more so. So that's basically what I've been doing. And then I've been, I'm not sure if I mentioned this earlier, but I've been prepping, getting ready for a senior level course we run here, the Transnational Security Cooperation course.
Yeah.
That's upcoming in July.
Yeah.
But, you know, planning usually takes place 6 months
yeah.
in advance. And then in between two iterations of the course in July and December, we have a workshop being planned on the US-India bilateral dialogue on defense industrial base. And we're targeting that. Well, it's scheduled for September.
Nice.
So between July and
Are you leading or participating in that?
I'm leading.
Are you? Oh,
I'm
wonderful.
Leading the workshop.
And the TSC as well, the course?
I'm leading the TSC too. Thanks for asking. Yes.
Yeah. So that, no doubt staying busy.
Yeah, it keeps you busy because each of these require at least a minimum of 6 months run up to it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have, we're going to Brunei for a course.
Yeah, you're going to bring you there. Both of you actually are going to come out there. We are actually going to do a show out there in Brunei in June. So we're excited about that.
Prepping lectures for that. And one is going to be a new lecture. So prepping for that.
Yeah.
So one is kept busy within the center and outside. Things are happening. So you're trying to keep track.
Now, in fact, I asked both of you to give lectures on the book chapters that you're doing in the next book coming out, America's Strategic Edge, which will be out before we go there, and we'll take copies of us there with us. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
so
go ahead.
If I've impressed you enough with what I've been doing, let's hear what you've been doing.
Yeah. So like both of you, this place doesn't slow down. So extremely busy doing things. But fun. So last night got in the mail a new book that I've just started reading. I'll have it read before, you know, much longer, but it's Odd Arne Vestad's new book, The Coming Storm, Power, Conflict, and Warning from History. And so he's a Norwegian professor, academic. He looking at the parallels with the First World War and the lead up to it and today and what's happening. And so, you know, I read all the time. All of us do. And I was excited when this came in the mail yesterday. It's just released. And so, so that's one of the things I'm doing. Writing a chapter for Joanna Sekura. She's a associate professor in Poland there at the National Defense University there. And she's a visiting, or she's an adjunct here out here with us as well. But anyhow, she's doing a book on lawfare, and I'm doing a chapter in that book, and it'll come out. Well, I've got to submit it to her by next month, and it'll be in Palgrave Springer's publication. And so that and other things. And so what brings us here today?
Well, it doesn't seem like you're very busy enough. You didn't talk about the book that you're bringing out next month, the amount of work that's going
to
be.
So hopefully the second volume to the Strategic Edge looks like a trilogy right now, but it's a series. Second volume of that we'll look to send off to print this month, the end of the month. And then we'll have it in hand there shortly thereafter, and it'll be online before it's in print. But we're really close to finishing that up. It's exciting.
So it is a far more massive effort than your earlier book. Would you say that? And if so, why?
It is, I don't know if it's, there's a lot going on. So this is one of many plates. I don't know if they're balls or plates. I feel like if they fall, they'll crack. And so, that's up in the air spinning, but it has been a lot of fun. It's turned out 16 chapters. It looks at, so it's America's Strategic Edge. It'll celebrate the nation's semi-quincentennial, the 250th anniversary. It looks at deterrence, lethality, and warrior ethos, and it really gets after the department's core focus areas right now. And so we're going to do that. Now, enough about that. Let me switch us over to today. We're talking about this framing of the Indo-Pacific as disruption, division, and competition. And you know that is the framing of this series, the Strategic Edge series. And I lay that out in the first chapter of the book that came out last year, titled Edges of Instability. And so I lay out this framework to understand that we are no longer no longer. We are not on a single path trajectory within this region. And you may say, well, when have we? Or what, you know, what is this compared to? And clearly, we often frame things in eras. And so there was a Cold War era, and things were divided, and they were divided by geography and by ideologies. And it was like that way for a very long time. I mean, the end of the Second World War in 45, if you will, until the fall of the Soviet Union in December of 91. And we end up with this unipolar moment where the United States is clearly the only superpower. And many people will remember that more than even perhaps they're going to remember the Cold War, though I was a Cold War warrior, so I remember it well. And therefore, this was a period of time where, you know, globalization was being advanced, and more engagement was seen to stitch us all together closer. That's changing. That's changing significantly. And so when we often think about this area, we're thinking about, you know, as practitioners, as policy makers and stuff, we often make analogies to playing chess and how somebody is, you know, 2-3 moves ahead of somebody else. I don't think that that's an effective way. It's less effective in trying to understand the region as a chess game. And I see it more as a game of Dungeons and Dragons. Now, I asked if either of you had played Dungeons and Dragons, and neither of you have. And it came out in the mid-70s, which is a small period of my life when I started playing Dungeons & Dragons and did it for maybe half a decade. So I didn't do it a long time ago since I've played it, but I remember it well. And things are changing. The rules are the same. The game perhaps is the same, but the environment shifts. These constant constraints are evolving, and the players have to continually adjust to this changing environment. And some people will have seen the movie Dungeons and Dragons, so maybe that sticks to them a bit. But this is quite different. And so just because you played it that way the last game doesn't mean you can play it like that this next game. It changes significantly. And so as we think through this, in my mind, disruption, it exposes these vulnerabilities we have, and they're happening all the time. It is, and actually, you know, we're going to divide this a bit. And I want, and Sham, you're going to take us down the path and talk a bit about disruption, and then I'll do on division. And I know Andrew is going to take us down competition. I won't spend too much more time describing it at this point. But then division, it takes and it reorganizes these access to the systems. And so if disruption creates all these different obstacles, as it were, changes the board, then the division will tell us the different access. It is creating access to these global systems that is changing. And then competition is more about how we pursue strategic advantage on this, in this environment, on this board, in this game, if you will. It would be nice if these things just sequentially laid out, but they don't. They're dynamic. So I think if I were, well, let me take it to here. So I shared with you a paper that came out, frankly, it was only a few days at the time we planned to do this episode, but the Atlanta Council had gathered experts from U.S. Partners, Allies, and asked them about the National Defense Strategy, which had come out about 5 weeks ago now. Just a few days before this article had come out. And so they respond to it. And in this example, in my mind, anyhow, how we're not just reading the same document, but as our partners, our allies, competitors, they read this, they're reacting to their own vulnerabilities. They're reacting or hedging on their own risks. And so as you reading this or thinking in other ways, you can sense, I think, the disruption, division, and competition that is occurring by some of the things that are happening. So that's kind of how we kind of set this up. And so with that, Shyam, how about if we move over to you and talk to us about the disruption?
Okay, great. So I'm going to read out some of the points that I've made.
Yeah.
I think to sum it up, disruption now, at least in the Indo-Pacific, and I'm talking about the Indo-Pacific region particularly right now, is that in a nutshell, it is no longer episodic. Mm. It is structural.
Okay.
It is structural. But what do I mean by that? It's essentially, it's important to be clear that we're not talking anymore about isolated shocks.
Yeah, no, I think not. I mean,
or temporary turbulence.
Yeah.
Disruption has now become the operating condition of the region. Something states, if they're not already doing it, they need to do it. You plan through disruption, not around. You plan through and not around. So I think that's the key takeaway for me, based on all the readings. That's the way I would sum it. Now, what makes disruption different today is, again, I repeat this, it's not a single shock, because we're so used to thinking of disruption as some one particular episode which throws everything into disarray. It's no longer that. That's what I want to emphasize. It's a continuum. It's the way these shocks stack and interact. That's, again, an extension of the disruption that we're speaking about. So technology, it accelerates faster than governance. We know technology has always been an issue, good, bad, but now governance is lagging behind. And a classic example would be technology outpaces any regulatory frameworks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the governance structure has got a lot to do in catching up with it. And catching up with it is not seamless. There are challenges and so on.
Let's pull on that a minute, the technology piece, because it is all around us, right? The AI in its introduction, its integration into combat. I think we're seeing it in the combat operations in the Persian Gulf right now,
right.
And its integration there. We've seen it in other conflicts. When you were talking about, initially, my mind immediately went to the, remember, in COVID, how there were inability for workers to go, and so the chips, the semiconductors weren't going out, and then American factories, cars couldn't come off the assembly line because there weren't chips to go in them. The disruptions were just multiplying, and those problems would be different if we didn't have those degrees of technologies
Correct.
Embedded in all of that.
Correct.
And you touch one thing, and it just comes out somewhere else.
Absolutely. You said it. So I would also talk about climate stress. Now that collides with fragile institutions increasingly so. Then you have what you just mentioned, political shocks. They unfold in digitally saturated environments.
Yeah.
And that makes governance, let's say that poses an increasing challenge for governance too. So now you're having environments where narrative moves far more rapidly than response. I would say 35 years ago, we had something called the CNN effect, which was basically exactly this. When narrative moves faster than response, and because the pressure on responding was, let's say, enormous, decisions were made erroneously. It's just because they had to be speedy. And why did they have to be speedy? Because of the technology and the environment it was occurring in. So I'll say, and I think this echoes from the book that we're putting together, that crises are no longer anomalies, but they're overlapping waves, going back to what you said. So then the other thing I would add is disruption reshapes timelines, decision timelines, which I just mentioned, risk tolerance, as well as deterrence logic. And what do I mean by that? So disruption isn't just a humanitarian or economic challenge. It's a strategic one. And I think that's the point some people might miss. It is a strategic one. It compresses decision-making timelines. It erodes predictability. Now, we are so used to predictability, we are not prepared for unpredictability.
Yeah.
We may think we are if it's one episode, but when you have overlapping waves, the level of predictability, unpredictability exponentially rises.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And it bears, you know, the government's vulnerabilities in this. And so when things are going well, we're just doing things.
Yes.
And as soon as there's something boils up, it exposes how fragile that we may actually governments may be, or challenges that it presents. And then when they're multiplied.
Yep. And so, yes, and this makes signaling much harder.
Yeah.
And we know that narrative and signaling is quite paramount into how these crises are dealt with or handled.
Yeah.
And in that environment, therefore, miscalculation does not require intent at all. It just requires speed. Okay. And then the new national defense strategy, it's being read through disruption, not on stable ground. Unlike in the past, you could read it on stable ground, but now you're reading it through disruption. So the new national defense strategy is landing in a region which is already conditioned by disruption.
Yeah.
And you can draw a number of examples. It matters simply because strategies assume absorption time. You don't have you don't have that luxury of absorption time anymore. It requires institutional clarity. The less said about that in today's environment, the better. And shared baselines, especially if you're looking at things like regional cooperation, for instance, or even intra-government agencies. So these are conditions that don't exist uniformly across the Indo-Pacific right now. That would be my big takeaway. So many regional actors, they're not reacting to the strategy as a settled guide like they used to in the past. They're interpreting it as another signal in an already noisy environment. So I think the key point is disruption doesn't fit everyone equally. The more uneven the shock, the harder it is to maintain shared assumptions. And I think one thing I'm going to keep an eye out for is looking at regional institutions in the Indo-Pacific, how well they're going to be faring or not faring in the current environment. So that's one of the things I'm tracking based on what I think disruption is.
Yeah.
And that uneven exposure itself is disruption of a kind between allies, partners, and smaller states. That's where we start to see the conditions for division emerge. Okay. So that even that unevenness, I think, is what we'll talk about when we get to division.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. And so I think as I talk about division, I think one of the things I want to start off with is what has stayed the same. So we've had division, and we still have it in certain ways. So geographically, the Korean Peninsula is still divided since the end of the Second World War. The Taiwan Strait with what's happening with Taiwan and China, the South China Sea, the line of actual control in the Himalayas, these are all geographical divisions, and we're used to those. We've had those. They continue. And we have ideological divisions. But those two things, geographic and ideological, I think is what defined the Cold War period. But we still have those. They haven't gone nowhere. And so then what's new? And you might argue, and the new is in how it's working. If I pull back on your description of disruption, mentally I was thinking, if you had a playing board, if it was a chessboard, and every one of these disruptions then formed, you know, these peaks that were popping up on the board, these are all things you've got to contend with. And in addition to those things that you have to contend with, go around, etc., we now are going to divide around these things. And it is going to control the access to these things, perhaps. The board has changed, the access to them is now going to change. We may prevent others from having access or exclude others. We may conditionalize and differentiate even amongst our allies and our partners. We went through a long period of the United States established allies and partnerships within the region, and the United States, without a doubt, was a dominant partner leading through this. And people, that works so great. Can't we just keep the thing going like that? That might have kept going like that, except of all these disruptions that have gone about it. And some of them we have created, but many of them have created themselves. The exposures that were presented made us realize we had to do things different. So what do I mean? The 2008 Great Financial Crisis revealed that there were vulnerabilities as capital could be immediately evaporated. The ability to then have access to, you know, for shipping insurance. We just saw in the current conflict going on that if insurance dries up suddenly, even though you've got the thing to ship, you can't ship the thing because you can't take the risk because you don't have insurance. These multiply. The 2019, you know, COVID-19 revealed that while there are efficiencies in interconnection in the globalization of production, there's also a whole lot of risk that comes there. And then suddenly, when things really, really matter and you can't get these things, couldn't get protective covering for, you know, face covering, different things for people, you suddenly it became a vulnerability. And all of these things. And so then that was a disruption. And then we start dividing. Say, well, we are going to, who can have access to these things? We start doing friendshoring or nearshoring and creating these preferred accesses because of those things. But then it wasn't enough that, because there's not a plenty. We've got enough for everybody. There's just not that. Everybody has to contribute. And so we find ourselves in this where maybe there wasn't the contribution before, but there are more requirements now to be on this. And so we're seeing that. And I would argue that when we read through this analysis, this Atlantic Council analysis, we start to see some. And so there are five countries that experts that responded on this, Japan, Korea, Philippines, Australia, and Taiwan. And as you read through it, you could see how they felt differently as they were reading the National Defense Strategy. I think Japan, as they read it, they felt that the United States was taking a softer tone with regards to China in it than it had. And these things don't represent so much just whimsical changes as they represent readings of the environment and recognizing that what got us here probably won't get us there. And therefore we have to alter, we have to change on these things. And because we're trying to bring many people along with us to make those changes, it can be painful. Change is one of the harder things human beings do, right? And so we saw those or South Korea, as they read within it, you know, their critical but limited support from the United States. They're grappling with that and saying, what does that mean? And part of it is because the United States isn't just looking at the Korean Peninsula as the only area of concern or potential conflict in the region. It's so much broader. And so they're pulling allies along with them in some of this, and allies are trying to understand how this means. And so the division is also, as I said, is differentiated, and it is in some regards being, there are requirements. We're asking partners to stand up and do more than they have. And this is part of that division, not to separate them from it, but categorization within, you know, we need you to do some of these more. Taiwan is reading it and saying, I've got to provide more. I got to spend more. Japan's got to step up more. Korea's got to provide more of its own defense on the peninsula. And the Philippines is looking, and part of this, they look and they think, while they've been leaning in heavy with the United States on defense, they probably recognize that economically, they're still in the region, and they're thinking, you know, like Vietnam, how can we have more economic inter-engagement with China? Because you can't just separate completely. And so like you had mentioned, as the rapidity of with it, which this is going on, doesn't allow for countries to take a lot of time to try to figure it out. They're having to figure it out as they go because it's moving so quickly. And so some of my thoughts on decision. Yeah.
So you mentioned five countries. So I'm looking at, and again, I don't have numbers to demonstrate it, the validity of what I'm proposing. And I think most other smaller countries in the region are basically looking at the NDS as an incentive to hedge smarter.
I have no doubt that, I mean, you must be right. The so Andrea and I sat down, we talked about small states, and I know it's an area of expertise and stuff. And so as you think, these small states are constantly trying to figure out how to hedge and the needle, throw the needle.
I wasn't thinking that small. I was even thinking as small as India. So I go from there.
Yeah. So what are you thinking?
Regional powers.
Yeah, I just think, that's the word, regional powers. I forget the lexicon now and then.
Yeah.
But I think for them, it is, okay, how do we hedge smarter?
Yeah.
And again, it's time of turbulence for everybody. There's churn. And I think those who hedge, for them, the main takeaway is, okay, there's no getting around this. Let's hedge smarter. And I don't know how that translates into action. I think that suggests a study needs to be, one needs to be tracking that.
Yeah. But I have no doubt that they must be thinking that as they try to think through their responses.
Yes. How do we hedge smarter?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Andrea?
Yeah.
Competition. What do you think?
Competition. So both of you all have set this up perfectly because this is the environment that geopolitical competition is happening.
Yeah.
And in your setup, I think it was a really good illustration. I like the Dungeons and Dragons, even though I've never played it, because I think it is a better example than chess because of the complexity and because of the lack of predictability.
Yeah.
So if we think about what geopolitical competition looks like, I'm going to put on my, background in international relations as a IR scholar. I'm going to put my hat on here about competitive multipolarity.
Yep.
If we're talking about competition, what does competitive multipolarity mean? So when we talk about polarity in international relations, how is power distributed throughout the system,
right?
And so, historically, we think of usually three types of polarity, basically. Yep. Like we have unipolarity, which is where there's this clear superpower, post-Cold War, as you mentioned, the United States, kind of a clear unipolar moment. Bipolarity, Cold War. And it was kind of clear, like, who are the two powers, right? Yeah. We know that it's the Soviets and it's the United States, and we are going to choose to align or not align somewhere between those two. But then when you get to multipolarity, you have a much more complex environment, right? It could be three or more powers. There's also regional complexities as well with regional powers. And so when you have that multipolar environment, what you're introducing is more uncertainty. Now, in international relations, uncertainty is one of the biggest problems of how do states deal with uncertainty. In a unipolar environment, we know who the power is. There is less uncertainty. So, scholars vary on how they think about it, but when there's less uncertainty, it seems like there's more stability. When there's bipolarity, sure, there is a risk of conflict, especially between the two poles or the two powers, but there's still some predictability. Like, we know how the power is distributed in the world right now. But when we get to multipolarity, that's a lot of moving parts. That's a lot of complexity. Now, I gave examples for unipolarity and I gave examples for bipolarity. And you referenced at the beginning with this book.
Yes.
Multipolarity. Not a fun time because it's, the First World War is usually the example leading up to it of a multipolar environment. A lot of uncertainty about alignment, but also just like if something happens, what do we do? And sometimes we might get pulled into conflicts that we didn't necessarily ever want. And we're not even sure why we're fighting in the first place. But because of that uncertainty, it's created an environment that leads to states sometimes having to make quick decisions without clear certainty of why they're doing it or what may happen and what the end result is. So we're dealing with uncertainty as we enter into this competitive multipolar environment. But just like how you mentioned, Dungeons and Dragons is different each time. That, that doesn't mean we don't look back at history and learn from it and learn from the lessons of World War I. But it also doesn't mean it will be the same, because things are very, very different. We are, we don't have the Ottoman Empire. Right. We are, in this post-colonial environment. We have globalization, technology. All of these are very, very different variables of how states are going to think about themselves in this geopolitical environment. So, speaking of hedging, that's how states are going to have to decide. Now that there is this emerging multipolarity in the region, where do I fit in? Whether I am a small or micro state like Kiribati or Tuvalu or Maldives, or I'm a medium power, I'm India, there's lots of different options there. So states are having to make decisions in this environment. How do they want to be perceived? Where do they want to align, right? So when we have uncertainty though, and we have uncertainty in a multipolar environment, what we also have is a higher risk of miscalculation. So miscalculation in this type of environment, because there's so many variables, then it means it's more likely. Yeah. So we also have misperceptions. So how states are perceiving, why did the other power or why did this other state do what they did? And they might misperceive that because of such a complex environment, because of the disruption and the division, that's going to build into the decision that they make. So the complexity that the two of you have already covered in this multipolar environment, that makes this environment, more dangerous.
Yeah.
And that's because we can have miscalculations, and miscalculations, especially in a world with nuclear weapons, is not good. So how do you help with addressing some of those miscalculations? Well, one of those is, what is the relationship that you're going to have with your partners and allies so that they feel, where their alignment is or what you are going to do, that other countries are able to have an idea of what your alignment is. So if we think about, the NDS, we've mentioned the NDS. It's certainly different than previous NDSs for the US. And I think one of the themes that emerges out of that, as both of you discussed, is burden sharing. Yep. So with burden sharing, that is that, there is a reorientation of the expectations of allies and partners of the US. And that is that, you need to increase the amount of defense spending, rethink, how you're addressing security. And, at first there might be some hesitation, oh, does that mean that you're backing off? You're not going to help us? No, it's about, again, that we are going to address this more complex environment. And you are also, building up your own as well, right? That this is also an opportunity to advance your own defense as well. So that is sort of a reordering of what the environment looks like in a multipolar environment. And you also see new things emerge as well. You have the Quad, you have AUKUS, you have increasing partnerships with other countries. And all of that is going to shape how states or how groups of states are thinking about themselves in this new multipolar environment. And so that might mean hedging. Smart hedging, I like that. I think that that's really good. States are going to evaluate, now that this is changing, where do I sit?
Where do I fit today? And yeah, where am I going to fit tomorrow? So
they have to think with the shadow of the future of how do I fit in? I have economic partners, but my economic partners may not want to be my security partners. But, if you're a small state and you have limited options, sometimes you have to multi-align based on what it is that other partner can provide. Maybe it's infrastructure, maybe it's defense. And so states have this, speaking of balance, they have to balance what their priorities are and how they're going to align in this new, much more complex system. So,
go ahead. No, no.
No, I think we're seeing a situation where states have to compete while cooperating.
Yeah.
That's something that's unavoidable. Once upon a time, cooperation meant cooperation and nothing beyond that. You didn't compete, but now I do not see that possible. Going back to, and part of the reason is, it's not a chessboard. It's a crowded intersection. What happens in a crowded intersection? You have to follow rules so that, everybody gets to where they want to go. But at the same time, if you don't jostle, you'll never get to go where
Yeah,
you want to go.
if you've been in high and density environments in Asia, and if you just sit there and wait, you won't go anywhere, will you?
Absolutely. Well,
whether you're driving or you're walking.
Let's take the New York subway also.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's same as exactly right. When you're talking, you ticked off several mini-lateral groupings, which are indicative of, if we can't make the multilateral organizations work for us because there's so much division and competition going on, then you have to resort to forming mini-lateral groupings, the AUKUSes, the quads, many of these economic groupings of RCEP, the regional.
But the fact that most
comprehensive
RCEP,
economic partnership, I think is what it is. But China is the center of that. There's, I guess, 10 countries within Asia. It's a very large grouping. But then the CPTPP, the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, China's not in that one. And the United States is not in that, even though they put it up. And so you get these different groupings in economics as well as in security and the other ones. And this is indicative, I think, of the formulations of these divisions and competing.
Well, there's another indication I'm seeing, the fact that some of these groupings appear to be fly-by-night operations, and they're gone before you know it.
No, there's definitely.
So part of the reason is because alliances change and your hedging strategies change. And also the fact that now gray zone activities, once it was a very esoteric term, and now it's become a routine activity among nation states.
That's a true point.
Yeah, so when you look at all that, even the fact that some of these groupings are gone even before you can get your head around what they mean, and that's why I call them their fly-by-night groupings. You know, they might still exist as labels, and which occasionally some country is going to approach. It's like having a CV. I'm a member of this. I'm a member of that.
Well, even the U.S. has tried to put forward some groups that just didn't
take off.
The Indo-Pacific Economic Forum, the IPEF, was an example of one that tried to get off the ground, and it wasn't a trade organization, but it put out standards, and it just, not all of them are going to move. And so often in these mini laterals, you're trying to put together a number of things, hoping to create a balance that moves forward. No, all of them aren't going to succeed. But in the collective of it all, trying to move forward your this competition that Andrea is speaking about, it is about seeking advantage in this environment, this competitive environment. And so,
and what can give you advantage in one setting can be a disadvantage in others.
Be.
And so figuring out how do you balance all of that with your economic versus your security interest versus your geographic location, it's complicated.
Unless your narrative, being a certain kind of power.
It is definitely. Continue, Andrea. I know I cut you off.
No, you did not. I was reaching my end point, which is basically just because there has been, this multipolar environment in the past, there are lessons to be learned. As always, we should learn lessons from history.
Yep.
But this new environment is one that we haven't experienced this iteration before. And so we're learning as we go, and states are learning as they go, how they want to compete in this environment. And it's difficult. The decisions that they have to make. And sometimes you have to make mistakes and learn from them, and then you may realign. And I think, getting back to the NDS, how states are reacting to that is, with this new information, how am I going to align given the current environment and how I think? So again, based on perception, based on uncertainty, how I think that the United States and other powers may act in the future. So again, I have to make assumptions. I have to do that in an environment of uncertainty, and that can be really difficult. So states might misstep. And then, but not even to begin to throw in, there's elections that happen. And, in democratic countries, when elections happen, that can completely change the priorities of a new administration, of how they want to, what they see as their top priorities. And so that can happen, anywhere in the region, there's an election happening with every 1 to 2 years. And so that can cause realignment. And sometimes they rely on, disruptive narratives or division that happen. So that's another variable that you throw in to make the complex environment even more complex.
Yeah, no. I think this helped people start to be able to conceptualize how the security environment is not just a single linear trajectory, path that we're going down. It is extremely complex and dynamic. And maybe this construct of disruption, division, and competition is a way of helping to think and understand why there is so much change going on, and why states are angling to try to seek advantage in it. And so,
Well, I think it's a truism to state that disruption accelerates division. Now, I can be curious to see if the same disruption also incentivizes cooperation.
Yeah, I think it'll be a while before we find cooperation at the level we probably experienced in the unipolar moment, because I think that period is past. And so, I think as Andrew was speaking about this rising multipolarity and how it is causing a different level of friction than we experienced previously. And we say, well, why can't we just go back? Because going back is, I don't think it's an option. We could talk about how, the rise of China, the rise of other multi-polar states, that's sprung out of, after, post-colonial period, and how this has moved us into this direction, but we are moving into a different direction.
Yeah, and so I think my concern would be, even in stable times, when there's a misalignment of expectations, trust, and timelines, yep. It's difficult now with disruption and division in the picture. And even this entire exercise of multipolarity, at least the move towards that, I just think the misalignment between expectations, trust, and timeline is going to be even much more, make it much more harder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And so I think the next question is, if not multipolarity, what? That's looking ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. Well, with that, why don't we transition? Let's talk about wins and woes, but let's start with wins. And so, Andrea, how about if you lead out and tell us about a win for you, that you perceive in the region happening?
Yeah. So back in February, there was the first critical minerals ministerial that happened in DC, but that was with 55 nations, a lot of them from the Indo-Pacific. So that is about strengthening, diversifying, and securing the supply chain. So I think this is a long overdue conversation, and it was good to see so many interested nations coming from the region. So I think that is a big win.
No, it is definitely. And Korea, I think South Korea is the chair for this. We're going to talk about it more later this month when we come on.
Excellent.
So thank you for pushing that forward. Sean, what are you thinking? When?
Well, it's a little personal. And that's a couple of months ago, I put out a long form essay on Sri Lanka and the limits of literature.
That was good.
For a magazine, New Lines magazine. Yeah. And I was thrilled with the new part that essay led me to, because I got lots of reader feedback, and quite a number of it directed me to events in South Korea. And I think I reached out to you and Lamy for some clarification. You know, you associate these kind of insurgencies and conflict. Vietnam is it's like beating a dead horse. But for me, this was it was an eye-opener. And so I'm right now excited. I'm exploring that particular thread, which led me to something analogous to what happened in South Korea, in the Koreas. So for me, that was a win, because I learned something new, and I'm tracing the thread and developing something out there.
Mm. So this week I was reading Cobra Gold. 2026 just finished. It's a multinational military exercise that Thailand has been hosting now for 45 years. And so earlier this week, the commander of USFK, General Brunson, was in Thailand. He spoke about this. And Korea has been a participant for a number of years in this exercise. And they participated again in this one. I mean, the ROC Navy and the Marine Corps was there. And in fact, I've mentioned that Major General Valerie Jackson, she's the commander of MARFOR, Marine Forces Korea. She was there as well. We've had her here in the center. We've had all these people. But a new thing that just happened in this iteration was the integration of U.S. Space Forces Korea in this exercise. And it made me think about how, you know, the stress testing of this integration of space forces in these type of exercises, space being one of the domains of warfare. And this now, we are seeing its the results of having moved these component commands into space force commands into the region, and they're actually participating in the exercises. It wasn't that long ago, you know, we formed the Space Force. It wasn't that long ago that we then formed these different components that went out to the region, and so here now they're participating in these major exercises. And I thought that was a real maturation of the use of these capabilities, and as we watch this unfold there. And so kudos to that. Woes, what are woes happening in your part of the world, Andrew?
So I mentioned at the beginning that I just returned from the Philippines, which was amazing. We got to go out and see one of our fellow projects in action in the Bataan area in the West Philippine Sea. And so one of the boat that we actually were on, I learned once we got on it that was the boat that was involved in the chase and the collision that happened between the Chinese Coast Guard and Navy. And this was the Philippine Coast Guard ship that escaped it. So that was a little bit of a win.
I watched
win.
That was the YouTube, win. I think.
Yes. Getting to be on that was a win for me personally. But the context of some of the things that were happening, you know, in the West Philippine Sea, while I was there, is the woe that I've selected for this week, which is there has been a big uptick in the last couple of weeks near the second Thomas Shoal, with some concerning like potential developments of like activity by China in that region. Like the Philippines is doing a great job in responding to that and you know, being vocal about what's happening, but it doesn't change the fact that there is this increased activity and what that means for that region more specifically.
No, that's the complexity on that. Every time we're talking about these, I reflect back on discussions I've had with people and sat down with a couple, and we had these discussions. In fact, even in this book, we had Denny Roy. Were you here when Denny was
yes,
a faculty?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And so he wrote a chapter on the South China Sea and the complexities and all of that as well. And so, yeah, this is likely to get more complicated before it gets straightened out. How about Sean?
Well, my woe is one and a half woes, but the one I talk about, the big one, which is disruption, division, and competition in the Indian Ocean region. It was quite, disturbing, unsettling to see Mauritius and the Maldives, you know, going to a tug of war. Mauritius broke off diplomatic relations with the Maldives over the weekend, primarily because Maldives was pushing back on the Mauritius's claim on the Chagos Archipelago. And it was also refusing to accept the UK-Mauritius treaty. So that's not going down well, especially that Mauritius has broken off diplomatic relations. And President Moizu in the Maldives is pretty adamant that he's not going to take this lying down, that it should come to them simply because of its proximity to the island. So that would be my woe. The second one, the half one, today's elections in Nepal after the Gen Z overthrow. We'll see what the results look like. As we speak, it doesn't look that stability is going to be a given. It's not promising. So I'll know when I get home tonight.
You do some more reading? Is that what you mean?
No, on the phone calls. I'll be on the phone. Yeah. I'll be on the phone throughout tonight.
Actually, you put forward that is a topic in a future episode too, to talk about the Gen Z.
Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and Nepal.
Yeah, it's been some significant. You and I sat down and talked about all back when they had all the elections in South Asia,
right.
Power Politics, I think is what
we
titled
right.
it.
And, that was, yeah, some time back.
It was. And see the manifestation of all of that. I think I was thinking this week on a woe. This Monday, there was a testimony. The U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, the USCC. Jason Xu, who's out at the Hudson Institute, and he's a former politician in Taiwan. He was testifying, and he was speaking about, he would give, you know, a warning about that China in their gray zone activities, that they are, the concern that they could easily cut off Taiwan from the rest of the world by severing their undersea
cables.
There are 14 that connect Taiwan to the outside world, as it were. And so Jason, she was talking about how severing three of those, and these go through the Bashi Channel, which is just south of Taiwan, you know, north of the Philippines, that it would have a, you know, 95% of Taiwan's international bandwidth would be severed by doing that. Made me think about, as I was listening, reading that, I immediately thought about Divya Rai and her chapter in Securing India Submarine Cables, I think is what it was. It was chapter 14 of the book. And she was out here previously, and she's written for me a couple times. And she did a really enlightening to understand. And it was actually through her studies and her writing and editing of her pieces that started me thinking in this direction. And, you know, she's written for me in a couple books. And so I've been doing seas with this for a little while. But most of us don't give it a whole lot of thought about these underwater sea cables and the critical nature they are for the economies. You know, Jason Xu kind of laid out that a disruption would cost roughly $55 million a day in Taiwan. And that's before you even calculate the shockwaves that would come to the semiconductor supply chain, which would be obviously significant. And so that was raised as a real concern. And in fact, it without a doubt, it really is. And so, yeah, I thought I'd raise that today.
It's, I think, a potential topic for a future conversation.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Without. Well, you know, I also sat down with, I had Divya on Dialogue, and she talked about this as well. And that was a well-viewed episode as well. Let's go. We're running short on time. So, Sean, what you got coming up? What's in your near future?
Well, apart from the lead role I have in the courses and the workshop, I'm still writing.
Okay.
Like I always do, I'm working on 5-6 essays at the same time. I just finished one a couple of days ago. It should be out this week at some point. It's on Mauritius, Maldives.
Very well.
That bit.
We'll look for it.
Yep, me too.
Thank you. How about Andrea? What's coming up?
So I just joined the Mars team here at APCSS.
Yeah, that's an acronym, so tell us what that is.
So it's focused on the defense industrial base. And so our courses will start in May, but before doing that, we have to go to do site surveys before we go to these different locations.
Yeah.
And so one of the locations is Australia. So I'm going to go to Australia as part of the team next month to do the site survey. Yeah, in April, to get prepared for this upcoming course.
Are you going with me to the National Capital Region for MIPOC? Are you going in there early April, or you won't be on that?
I will be in DC for the Mars course, but not for MIPOC.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe
we haven't yet qualified to be in that.
You haven't qualified. There it is. So I got a couple of travels coming up. I actually have to go to I got to go to mainland here in another week or so. Had a family member that passed, and so I've got to go out there for that. And then I'll come back and then get back on a plane again and go out to the National Capital Region. And we've got the MIPOC. I've carried a course out there before.
I was part of that.
You were the mobile Indo-Pacific orientation course, and so we'll do that again. And then, of course, turn around and come back and then take a course out to Brunei. And that's going to be a lot of fun. So this is exciting. Oh, this has been wonderful to sit down and to have the discussion. We have got to do a better job by our audience not to have interruptions that keep us from putting it out.
You mean disruptions?
Yes.
No divisions.
No disruptions, without a doubt. Well, thank you. Let me go ahead and close this out. From all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for joining Strategic Voices. Please subscribe to receive new episodes in your feed and rate us so others can more easily find the conversation. We hope that you'll join us again on March 23rd for episode 4, Critical Minerals, Who Sets the Price? Rare earths, lithium, cobalt, and nickel are no longer just commodities. They are a strategic leverage. The question is whether coordinated demand can shift the balance of power in global supply chains. From professors Sham Taquani and Andrea Malji, I'm James Minnick. Until we meet again, aloha. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.